This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, the fallout and implications following U.S. President Barack Obama's recent trip to Saudi Arabia and Europe. Hello again, I'm Carol Castillo. President Barack Obama began his global tour with a trip to Saudi Arabia, where he met with Saudi leader King Salman and close associates. The oil-rich nation has been a long-standing strategic ally of the United States that today joins a U.S.-led coalition to defeat the so-called Islamic State. However, the relationship between the United States and Saudi Arabia has become strained in recent years, with Saudi leaders accusing the United States of courting their rival Iran with the recent nuclear deal and for not doing enough to undercut the regime of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad, who has attacked his own citizens and sparked a horrific civil conflict that has in part spawned the European refugee crisis. President Obama also traveled to London, where he had lunch with Queen Elizabeth II and met with Prime Minister David Cameron. President Obama issued an overt plea to the United Kingdom to remain in the European Union ahead of a June 23rd referendum. He also attended a trade show in Germany and met with Chancellor Angela Merkel. He sought to shore up U.S. alliances, promoted a new transatlantic trade deal, the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, and urged European nations to ramp up their contributions to the coalition fighting the so-called Islamic State. He said that even as European countries make important contributions against ISIL, another term for the Islamic State, Europe, including NATO, can still do more. Well, with us to discuss the ramifications of President Obama's trip to the Gulf and to Europe are two distinguished foreign policy analysts. Hussein Ibish is senior resident scholar at the Arab Gulf States Institute in Washington and former senior fellow at the American Task Force on Palestine, and Perry Kamak. He's an associate in the Middle East program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, and that's a policy group based here in Washington. Previously, Perry worked on issues related to the Middle East as part of the policy planning staff of Secretary of State John Kerry. Both gentlemen join me here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Welcome to you both.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Well, Hussein Ibish, let me begin with you talking about President Obama's trip to Saudi Arabia, his fourth trip to that country. Discuss what you think are the main sources of friction, especially from the point of view of the Saudis, and what, if anything, was accomplished to patch over those differences.
Sure. Well, the fraying of trust that's emerged in the relationship over the past few years is really based on two things. First is doubts about American intentions and commitment to the Gulf, stemming from policies, the outreach to Iran and the nuclear deal, and questions about what the United States really is trying to achieve with Iran, which have really arisen in the Gulf. And the other is what the Gulf perceives as a lack of a robust, credible American response to the Syrian catastrophe. That has combined with comments made by President Obama in a series of interviews, most recently with Jeffrey Goldberg of The Atlantic, in which he called the Saudis and others free riders, suggested they needed to, open quote, share, close quote, the Middle East with Iran, and really was very critical of them, and spoke about the need to pivot to Asia, an aspiration he's been repeating for a long time that hasn't happened. So this combination of the president's opinions and some American policies have really raised questions in the Gulf about, you know, the American commitment and the strength of the alliance and leadership. What happened was this trip did help to resolve things a bit. There was no major breakthrough. There's still no coordinated policy on Syria. But I think the real takeaway is the medium is the message here. The fact of the meeting was really important, and it's been confirmed that this is the second annual US-GCC summit, heads of state summit. So there'll be an annual meeting on top of all the other dialogues that are structured in regular meetings with specific themes and specific times. The heads of state will meet annually. And that's unusual access for the Gulf leaders to the American president. And not a year will go by where they won't have an opportunity to talk to him face to face. So that's really important.
And that's something that started under President Obama's watch.
Yeah, the first one was last year in May 2015 when he invited the Gulf leaders to Camp David. This is the second one.
Turning to you, Perry Kamak, for your take on the so-called takeaway from President Obama's trip to Saudi Arabia. And do you also think that there weren't any great breakthroughs, but nonetheless, that this meeting now that has been established between the United States and the Gulf states is an important outcome?
Yeah, I agree. I think it was an important step. I think, frankly, the Gulf leaders understand that this is a president in the eighth year of his term. So I think expectations were, frankly, fairly low. And I think to some extent, leaders are beginning to look past the president, which is natural. If I can just comment on Hussein's comments, and I generally agree with the thrust, but I see things maybe in a slightly different perspective, which is that there are kind of two structural issues here. Mm-hmm. There are the personal relationships between the leaders, and I think the Gulf-U.S. partnership, more than almost any other relationship, really is based on high-level personal relationships, and then the broader kind of structural issues at play. And I think there's no secret that the president has a kind of cerebral, detached approach to foreign affairs that isn't particularly well-suited to the way of doing business in the Gulf. And on the flip side, in Saudi Arabia, you have a deputy crown prince, Mohammed bin Salman, who is really quite an unknown to the United States. We don't have kind of deep experience with him. So I think if you combine these two factors, it leaves some room for misunderstanding, which I think is part of the kerfluffle over the free rider statement. But even beyond that, I do think there are some deeper structural things happening, that this ultimately is a relationship built not on common values, but on common interests. And there's an awful lot of interests that are and remain in common. But I think given the turmoil in the Middle East, we're also seeing increasing divergences, of which Syria and Yemen and Iran are part of. And I think some of that will continue, frankly, into the next administration, whether Democratic or Republican.
Turning back to you, Hussein Ibish, we want to talk about the future, looking past, obviously, the presidency of Barack Obama. And I want to do that. But first, I want to refer to a very interesting panel that you actually hosted at your institute this past week, in which the author of the article, Jeffrey Goldberg, in the Atlantic Monthly, that is the one who interviewed President Obama, he thought that President Obama is what he called Philo-Persian, that part of these differences between President Obama and the Gulf states, particularly Saudi Arabia, has to do with perhaps this Iran deal and the belief that that is on the part of the administration, President Obama in particular, that Iran, that there is a great potential for perhaps U.S.-Iran relations, and this Iran deal was important in that regard, not just to deprive or rather prevent Iran from getting a nuclear weapon. Talk about that.
Yeah, I do think that you can detect in the president's comments and some of those of some of the other officials of his administration, the idea that Iran is an ancient civilization, whereas the Arab states are new and young and kind of raw and green, and that Iran is very sophisticated and the Arabs are not, and that the Iranians are fundamentally rational, whereas the Arabs are not. And all of this, I think, may have led to hopes that the nuclear deal might have been the harbinger of a new relationship with Iran emerging as a constructive force to help the U.S. and others ensure the stability and security of the Gulf region so that the U.S. could draw down and pivot to Asia. But I think what's happened is that the administration has had to confront the fact that Iran did not rise to the challenge, that in the 8 months of implementation of this agreement, Iran doubled down on its aggressive foreign policy, increased its ballistic missile testing, which violates U.N. Security Council resolutions, and the spirit, if not the letter, of the nuclear agreement and international expectations, and that it's only intensifying its efforts to use proxies and destabilization to increase its influence in the Arab world. So that really underscores the fact that the U.S. lacks good alternatives to its traditional Arab allies in the region. Iran is certainly not going to be that alternative, even though I think many may have hoped that, possibly even the president. And the Arabs lack alternatives to the United States. They like to talk about Russia and China and the Europeans, but in the end, the Arabs and the Americans need each other. Perry's right. This is a relationship built on interests and not love or values, but the interests remain solid, and that's reflected in the fundamentals. The U.S. military presence is at a historic high, if you factor in that there isn't a major war. It's certainly much higher than pre-9/11 levels. The military weapons sales and technology transfers, historical high. Diplomatic transactions, a historical high. Investment is a historical high. And civil society exchange. All of this under Obama is at a historic high. So that there's this interesting dichotomy between perceptions on both sides and reality. The perceptions are that this, and it's real too, because of the importance of interpersonal relationships, and perceptions are very important, as Perry was saying. At the same time, the basic underlying brass tacks reality is that there's a very strong relationship because the interests remain very strong.
Turning to you, Perry Kamak, because you worked closely under Secretary of State John Kerry, I'd like to get your perspective with regard to the value the Obama administration has placed on getting the nuclear deal with Iran. Do you think, as is somehow perceived in, particularly in the Gulf states, that President Obama was so bound and determined to get this Iran deal that it overshadowed just about everything else, including the Syrian conflict, which now we know has in part spawned this migrant crisis, has certainly emboldened Russia and President Bashar al-Assad, who obviously is not going anywhere anytime soon, as we note this week. More attacks on civilians. A hospital was struck. It doesn't look like the peace talks are really going anywhere. What's your perspective on the importance that President Obama has placed on this Iran deal, and to what extent do you think it has overshadowed and is part of the problem with the Gulf allies?
Well, it's certainly perceived that way in the Gulf. And I think that a major objective of the president going into the talks in Riyadh last week were really to say, look, we understand that you have reservations about this agreement, but the deal's a reality. At this point, it's really the implementation. And if fully implemented, and there are some concerns, and I think there will be concerns going forward about the Iranian adherence to the very strict details of the agreement, but if the agreement is adhered to, it does ensure that Iran will not have a nuclear weapon for the next generation, decade or so, or probably more. So I think the point going forward is we've managed to take off the table the Iranian nuclear program, not permanently, but at least for the next several years. Now we need to work on bolstering this partnership in all the areas we're talking about, more effective regional policies, whether it's in Syria or Yemen or in Iraq.
Indeed, but I think what the Gulf allies are most worried about is not so much the nuclear program, but the actual hegemonic stance of Iran in the region and the so-called windfall from the sanctions relief that will help, or rather that is perceived to support nefarious activities, and the perception that the United States is not doing quite enough to combat those aspects, that is, those activities, as aggressively as they think it should.
So it's interesting. If you look at the actual bilateral security and military cooperation with Saudi Arabia in particular, but with the other GCC countries, it's actually as robust now as it's ever been. Just within the last decade, basically during the term of Barack Obama, the Saudis have purchased $100 billion in U.S. arms equipment. So in terms of the U.S. commitment to the protection of the Gulf sovereignty itself, I think things are in great shape.
Exactly.
The real challenge, though, is what's beyond the Arabian Peninsula. The real challenge is not in Saudi Arabia or, frankly, even Bahrain or the United Arab Emirates. It's in the region. And unfortunately, with a region that's kind of in collapse, I'm not sure anyone really has answers to deal with the underlying political and governance challenges that gave rise to these conflicts in the first place, and which frankly opened the door wide open for Iranian interference.
Well, just one quick follow-up before we turn to another topic, and that's back to you, Hussein Ibish. Mm-hmm. You know, some would argue that it was the inaction of the Obama administration with respect to Syria, the drawing of red lines, the saying Assad needs to go, none of which was actually enforced, that is part of the problem, not to in any way diminish what Perry Kamak has said about the need for better governance and so forth.
It's a big part of the problem, and here's the reason why. The United States perceives the Syrian war as a problem, but one that's containable and one that's manageable, and it's not a priority. It's not a huge deal for the administration. They've made that clear. From the Gulf Arab point of view, the Saudi, Emirati, it's a Qatari point of view, it's an existential crisis because they think the strategic future of the Middle East will be decided in Syria. If Iran can keep control of most of Syria and of Damascus and whatnot through maintaining the Assad regime, they believe Iran will have a mini empire in the region and will be the dominant force in the area. But they think that if Iran can be beaten back and the Assad regime overthrown, then Iran will be contained and reduced to being a very huge power, but a manageable one. So they think everything's at stake in Syria.
So back to you, Perry Kamak. That's the point I was making, not saying that the Obama administration isn't doing an enormous amount to shore up the Gulf allies and Israel also. But this inaction on Syria, which many perceive as having helped to bolster Assad, who is enormously backed by, obviously, Iran and now Russia, that this is the crux of the problem, and that as long as this conflict persists and festers, the region will not be stable. We're seeing a migrant crisis, much of which can be attributed to the Syrian civil war, now afflicting Europe, which is affecting the entire world.
Indeed. The only kind of exception I'd make to Hussein's comment is I think the president recognizes that Syria is an enormous problem. It's a festering wound that's basically collapsing the kind of security architecture of the region. The problem is what to do about it. And I think the political context here matters. Remember that President Obama was essentially elected with two mandates, mm-hmm. fix the economy and end U.S. presence in wars in the Middle East. And I think the president looked at this challenge and saw time and time and time after again, no good options. And remember, we were in Iraq for 25 years now, a quarter century. And I would argue that we're no closer today in 2016 than we were in 1991 in terms of addressing the root political causes.
All right.
Let me add one quick point. It's significant that almost every former official in the Obama administration who dealt with Syria policy, beginning with Secretary Clinton and almost everybody else who has left, is highly critical of at least some aspect, if not all, of the Obama administration approach. So it's not just an outsider's perspective. It's near unanimity in his former team.
Well, that is an important point. And then we'll speak after the break about Germany and other issues and Europe looking toward help from the United States. There's also the concept of a safe zone, which the administration, at least until now, has rejected. But we will get to that in just a moment. But first, you're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. My guests are Hussein Ibish, he's senior resident scholar at the Arab Gulf States Institute in Washington, and Perry Kamak, he's an associate in the Middle East program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. That's a think tank here in Washington. We're discussing the impact of President Barack Obama's recent diplomatic tour to Saudi Arabia and soon to Europe. This is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castillo VOA or connect with us on Facebook. Here's a shout out to Chibundu Uchegbu. He's a loyal listener from Owerri State, Nigeria. If you want to hear your name on the show, please send us an email to encounter@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on Facebook. Well, back to you, Perry Kamak, to talk about President Obama's trip to Europe, to the UK, to Germany. But following on the discussion about the migrant crisis, which has in many respects been partly spawned by this Syrian civil conflict, do you know if anything had been decided after the talks regarding what could be done to help stem the tide of the migrants in addition to the recently agreed upon U.S.-Turkish deal? What more do you know have the United States and its European allies agreed to do?
I think, obviously, the Syrian conflict was a major point of discussion both during the visit to Riyadh and in Europe. I think the EU deal with Turkey is important in beginning to stem the tide. I think the cessation of hostilities, although now looks to be falling apart, frankly, but I think probably helped a little bit in a very narrow tactical sense. But ultimately, the only way to really deal with this problem is through a political solution to Syria. And unfortunately, at this point, that looks pretty far away.
Again, you know, as Hussein Ibish said, you know, critics would say both former allies and members of Obama's administration would say to come to a political solution, you need to shore up forces on the ground, those of the rebel and the civilian opposition. But short of that, what about President Obama's talk about the UK staying within the European Union? We know a referendum is coming up. To what extent do you think that helped or hurt that cause? And what are chances for the so-called TTIP, that transatlantic trade and investment partnership that he advocated on the trip?
Well, we'll see. Obviously, as I mentioned, we're in year 8 of a presidency, so I think his outspoken advocacy for a no vote on the so-called Brexit is kind of low stakes politically, and I'm sure if it goes through, the White House will trumpet him as being the decisive factor. If it's defeated for some reason, that will be seen as a kind of mistake. But I think the reality is this will be decided by British voters on British terms, and I'm not sure that it will be hugely influential either way. In terms of TTIP, I personally am a supporter of it. I think it will really help shore up the transatlantic partnership for another generation. It will be very, very difficult to get something that big passed through a Senate in an election year. So hopefully the president and the administration and his European partners are building a foundation for it. But I think real action will have to happen in the next administration.
All right. We'll talk about the next administration in a moment. But first, let me turn to Hussein Ibish for your reaction to President Obama's European tour, his advocacy for the UK to remain within the European Union, whether you think anything can come of this trade deal, and any more on the migrant crisis and the fight against the so-called Islamic State.
Well, TTIP is a very good idea, and I agree with Perry. I'm sure it will happen because it's in everybody's interest, but I think it will have to wait until the election cycle is over. I also agree that the American president's opinion is not likely to have a huge impact on British voters. They don't look to Washington for guidance on this issue, and maybe they should, but they don't. In terms of the Islamic State, I think that it's right now you've got a situation where both the Europeans and the Americans are becoming more interested in ramping up their efforts in Syria against ISIL, against the so-called Islamic State monstrosity, because of attacks in Europe and because it's spreading. It's spreading into Libya. It's spreading into Yemen. It's spreading beyond this so-called caliphate that it established in Syria and Iraq. So what it's showing is that even as it's being degraded, especially in Iraq, losing territory and losing men, it not only is it able to replenish its supply of fighters to some extent and keep up a troop of estimated about 20,000, it's also able to spread into other areas of anarchy in Libya and Yemen, and where there's no governance, there's an empty space for ISIL to come, and it's a potent brand name. So obviously, just attacking it in Syria and Iraq isn't good enough, and more is going to have to be done. And that also implies then a more comprehensive strategy that integrates the approaches in Iraq and Syria that have been kept separate, and that recognizes increasingly that Assad and ISIL are two sides of the same sectarian existential conflict coin, and that, you know, having an Iraq first policy against ISIL doesn't work. You have to deal with it both in Syria and Iraq, and having an ISIL first policy in Syria doesn't work either. You've got to address both Assad and ISIL at the same time.
Chancellor Merkel said that she supports a safe zone in Syria. Yep. At the same time, is there any appetite for creating that?
Not under Obama, but I think the next administration is going to have to look very carefully at Syria policy, and I think they will. Safe zones, no-fly zones, no-drive zones, especially when there's an agreement with Russia that the areas in which it's being done are acceptable to Russia, which can be done. You know, I think that's going to be looked at very, very carefully.
Turning to you, Perry Kamak, to talk about the future, the next administration. This last week, we heard from the presumptive Republican nominee, not yet, but Donald Trump looks like he's set to take the nomination. At any rate, he made a so-called foreign policy speech. Do you have any reaction to that? And to what extent do you hear anything from the regions, whether in Europe or the Middle East, to his points? And with that, what about the alternative? Should Secretary of State Hillary Clinton clinch the Democratic nomination? What are people saying in the region with respect to both of these potential nominees?
Well, with regards to Mr. Trump's speech, I have to say we should see it for what it is, which is a campaign speech. There's no secret that his appeal is not built on his foreign policy chops. It's on kind of anger and frustration of American voters. And so to me, I don't feel, having watched the speech, that I know anything more about what a Donald Trump foreign policy would look like today than I did 2 days ago. He reflects a certain kind of isolationist spirit, which is a thread that goes back in American history, back to our founding. So It's not new, but I'm not sure what a Trump foreign policy would look like. In terms of Hillary Clinton, look, she was Secretary of State. She was First Lady for 8 years. She's a very well-known quantity, both in the Middle East and Europe, has deep relations. So I think it's not surprising, even putting politics and ideology aside, she's a known quantity. Mm. And I think if foreign leaders had votes, she would be the choice of most of them, although, of course, they don't.
But definitely,
last word to you is saying,
Middle Eastern leaders, I think, are quite happy with the idea of a Hillary Clinton administration. They know her, they respect her, and they would welcome it. As for Donald Trump, I think he fills them with fear and alarm and horror, and they see him as essentially Islamophobic, a demagogue, and a nativist. They don't know what his foreign policy would look like, but they're very concerned about his anti-Muslim comments and see him as a wild card. And I think that the thing that ultimately reassures them is their strong belief that he won't win, and that Hillary Clinton, if that's the contest, that she will take it.
On that note, I'm afraid that's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guests, Hussein Ibish, senior resident scholar at the Arab Gulf States Institute in Washington, and Perry Kamak, associate in the Middle East program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Encounter was produced in Washington. Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guests. Our engineer was Cornelius Tenner. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on the Voice of America.